I'm Yael Cassander.
This will be a big year for decisions.
There'll be a lot going on, and you'll need to stay on top of all of it.
AM 580 is here to help, but we need your support. Be one of 250 people to call on June 11th, our one-day Thursday fun drive.
You can call then and renew your membership or make a first-time gift.
Your support means more of the news and information you expect from AM 580. You can also give online right now at willpledge.org. And thanks.
Say it loud! I'm glad I'm proud!
What do JCPenney's and McDonald's have in common? Discrimination against blacks in the early 1900s.
They marched on pennies because pennies were not high in the blacks.
Hear the firsthand stories of Champaign residents Irma Bridgewater and Ruby Hunt. Youth Media Workshop, a service of Illinois Public Media, presents I Remember, I Believe, Mondays and Tuesdays in June at 4:45 and 6:45 p.m.
It's 2:41. In sports, the White Sox and Tigers in St. Louis and Colorado open today's relatively light nine-game Major League schedule. Underway in Chicago, the Detroit Tigers lead the White Sox 2-1, that game in the top of the fifth. And in St. Louis, Colorado leads the Cardinals 3-1 in the top of the fifth. The Cubs have the day off today. Any doubts about Tiger Woods being ready to defend his title at next week's U.S. Open were all but erased with yesterday's come-from-behind victory at the Memorial Tournament. After starting the final round four shots off the lead, the world's number one golfer birdied his final two holes en route to a 7-under par 65 and a one-stroke win over Jim Furyk. Woods missed 8 months of play after undergoing knee surgery following last year's U.S. Open victory. Roger Federer's French Open title isn't enough to surpass number one Rafael Nadal in the world rankings, but it did cut the Spaniard's lead by more than half. The second-ranked Swiss star was 4,490 points behind Nadal when play got underway in Paris. The deficit is 2,070 in today's rankings. Meanwhile, Nadal is having his knees checked by doctors and expects to announce his status for Wimbledon in the coming days. Nadal's website says the reigning Wimbledon champion is in Barcelona for medical tests. He's expected to make an announcement by Wednesday. Nadal withdrew from this week's Wimbledon tune-up at Queen's Club in London, citing knee trouble. His 31-match winning streak at the French Open ended with a fourth-round loss. Wimbledon starts on June 22nd. That's sports.
WI Law programs are made possible in part by Bavir Cafe 2, offering gourmet sandwiches, salads, and specialty coffees with seating inside or outside in the lower courtyard of the Institute for Genomic Biology next to Morrow Plotz on the U of I campus.
When the FBI seized $90,000 in very cold cash from Congressman William Jefferson's freezer 4 years ago, the FBI also raided his office. That was a first for a member of Congress, which is why that raid stirred up constitutional questions that delayed the criminal case. Tomorrow, William Jefferson, now a former congressman, goes on trial on bribery and corruption charges. NPR's Audie Cornish reports.
Let's start with the indictment. In 2007, a federal grand jury charged Louisiana Democrat William Jefferson on 16 counts of bribery and corruption related to his family's business ventures in West Africa. Jefferson has always maintained his innocence.
There are two sides to every story. There are certainly two sides to this story. There will be an appropriate time and forum when that can be explained and explicated.
The time is this week. The forum is a federal court in Virginia. Federal prosecutors will set out to prove that Jefferson is guilty of helping make trade deals in Nigeria and Ghana, provided he or his family was paid off, and that he did so in his official capacity, that he was peddling influence as a congressman. That last part won't be easy, according to University of Baltimore law professor Charles Tiefer.
There is a strong argument being made by the prosecution that while the acts by the congressman would have been legal if he hadn't taken money, the fact that he took money makes them illegal. But that doesn't resolve the question of whether this was an official act or not.
Jefferson argues that his actions were part of his private dealings with no relation to his official duties. At the same time, he and his lawyers have objected to all sorts of potential evidence they say is related to his legislative work. That's because many congressional duties, like voting and writing laws, are protected from prosecution. If it sounds confusing, that's because it is, says Stanley Brand, a defense attorney and former general counsel for the House of Representatives.
On the one hand, the defense is going to be saying, look, you can't go into his legislative activity. On the other hand, they're going to be trying to use it to show that he didn't do anything wrong. And the court's going to be faced with making judgments on all those things.
Jefferson has been challenging the charges in part by maintaining that some of the evidence is tainted. He says the FBI improperly raided his Capitol Hill office in 2006. And indeed, that raid has been deemed unconstitutional by a federal appeals court. The D.C.-based court ruled that rifling through the office violated the lawmakers' rights because the investigators saw legislative materials that are protected under the so-called speech or debate clause. That's supposed to prevent the president or other members of the executive branch from trying to intimidate lawmakers with whom they disagree.
Basically, the court has put off limits a lot of the type of investigative tools prosecutors typically use in these cases.
Former U.S. Attorney Peter Zeidenberg says actions such as questioning congressional staffers, conducting wiretaps, or searching anywhere an elected official keeps legislative work are now in question. The ruling even states that a legislator must be present for office searches and be allowed to pull aside legislative papers.
But, you know, who thinks they're really going to get the goods that way?
With this ruling in hand, Jefferson has filed numerous challenges, and lawyers say laid a roadmap for other defendants to delay prosecution. But others point out that it hasn't stopped corruption investigations into other legislators, and despite the delays, Jefferson will finally face a jury this week. Audie Cornish, NPR News, The Capitol.
Coming up this afternoon on The World, the White House has nominated a new ambassador to Mexico. Some Mexicans are not pleased, not because Carlos Pascual lacks diplomatic experience, but because he has special expertise in the problems of failed states. That's a sensitive topic in Mexico, where drug cartels have led to lawlessness. That story from Mexico in the day's news, coming up today on The World at 3 o'clock Central Time. At the heart of President Obama's economic recovery plan is the promise of new green-collar jobs. Workers concerned about being laid off from their blue-collar jobs are starting to wonder what these new jobs will look like. Julie Grant reports.
Michelle Forte has been a dye maker at the General Motors plant in Parma, Ohio, for 15 years. She says everyone at work is worried about the future of the plant and the prospects for the whole company.
It's a scary industry to be in right now. You know, they keep on sending our work to China, and my job might be next. You just don't know. It's scary to live in that environment every day. You know, you go into work and it's negative all the time.
Forte hasn't gotten a raise in 6 years. And in the future, if she stays as an auto worker, she's going to make a lot less.
I will tell you what I made last year, and that was $80,000. And this year, with the concessions that we've took and the overtime that we've lost, I'll be lucky to make 60. So, yeah, it's a drastic cut.
Forte decided to take advantage of job training money available at GM. She gets up at 5 in the morning to start work. Then after her shift, she heads to school. She and two co-workers have started taking courses at the new Green Academy at Cuyahoga Community College. They're learning what it takes to install solar panels, wind turbines, and to make buildings energy efficient. It's tough getting home after 10 at night, but Forte says learning to work in the clean energy field is a positive step for their future.
Because we wanted to get in on the ground floor. If it breaks open like we think it is, we want to have the education under our belt already.
But most auto workers aren't betting on an explosion of green jobs. At least they aren't spending their time in training classes, even if they've already been laid off. Joe Regola is president of the AFL-CIO of Ohio. The union represents everyone from musicians to office workers to electricians. Regola says people who've been laid off have to make impossible choices if they decide to start training in a new industry. Do they continue looking for jobs to keep the unemployment check coming in, or do they go to school for retraining?
Am I going to go for training if I'm already laid off? Am I going to risk my unemployment benefits and go for training in an industry that may or may not produce real work down the road? That person, a person in that situation, should not have to make that choice.
And that's the big gamble. Do they invest time and effort to retrain for jobs that might never materialize? President Obama has said that a move toward clean energy production has enormous job creation potential. But some researchers say that's overblown. Andrew Dorchak is with the Case Western Reserve University Law Library. He co-authored a study titled Green Job Myths. The first myth, that there is a common understanding of what makes something a green job.
We figured out that there wasn't a really good definition of green jobs, especially if there are political subsidies involved that might be problematic.
Problematic because many of the jobs classified as green today aren't making wind turbines and solar panels in the Midwest. They're lobbyists, administrative assistants, and janitors working for environmental organizations in New York and Washington. And Dorchak's concerned the definition of green jobs will get even wider as government pockets get deeper.
It's subject to maneuvering, to people fighting to classify their jobs as green.
Dorchak says companies will chase the subsidies, and that could take away from government money to create productive jobs, jobs that could help people like Michelle Forte find work and improve the environment at the same time. For the Environment Report, I'm Julie Grant.
Support for the Environment Report comes from the Park Foundation, the George Gund Foundation, and the Gaylord and Dorothy Donnelly Foundation. You can find more information and share your thoughts at environmentreport.org.
It's 2:51. Up next here on the Afternoon Magazine, some wild sounds from a series that lets us listen to the natural world around us. The sounds were recorded by a graduate student named Megan Wyman. She spent 4 months studying an animal that once seemed to be on its way to extinction. She listened to bison in Nebraska, and she studied how male bison established their authority with a variety of snorts and grunts.
We would go out every day in the morning in an open bed truck, and we would drive out into the middle of the bison herd. We would select a bison, and this is a bison who is bellowing. He's either guarding a female or he's challenging another male, and we would start recording. And we do this for about 20 to 30 minutes until we feel we have enough bellows to kind of accurately know what sort of information he's giving. There's different parts of the call. Some will be long, some will be short, some have higher pitch or lower pitch. Some are very grumbly and rough, and some are high and wheezy. Some have flat tones, and others move up and down. And each of those is saying something in particular, we think, about the relative strength or quality or fitness or motivation of that male to fight other males and to gain access and matings to females. What we just heard there was what we call a bison fighting storm. A female may run through the herd, and when she does this, it attracts the attention of other males, and they'll start following and chasing her and other bison. And then when she stops, these males will stop, and they'll start bellowing back and forth, and they'll start pawing up the dirt and wallowing in the ground. And then they'll start fighting, and what they're trying to do is figure out who's the most dominant male so they can then gain access to the female. And there'll be huge clouds of dust. There'll be males headbutting each other, horning each other. And there'll be bison hair flying through the air. It's quite a sight to see. It's really amazing. Sometimes they would walk right past us, and they'd be within arm's distance away, and they're bellowing so loud it hurts your ears. And you're just really majestic and makes you feel like you're part of an ancient world.
Megan Wyman from the University of California, Davis, recorded those sounds. Swine flu became part of the statutory and common law in the United States in the 1970s and 80s. Commentator Amy Goddard gives us a historical perspective in this week's edition of Legal Issues in the News.
This isn't the first time we've been worried about swine flu. We celebrated the nation's bicentennial with, among other things, the National Influenza Immunization Program of 1976. The program, in the words of one court, was designed to inoculate the country's adult population against the threat of a swine flu epidemic. That would mean all the adults in the entire United States. That same court called it the largest immunization program in this country's history, one for which Congress initially appropriated $135 million disco-era dollars. Eventually, the court reported, over 45 million Americans, or one-third of the adult population, were vaccinated. The program was prompted by the discovery in New Jersey in early 1976 of a strain of the flu virus related to one that killed millions in the pandemic of 1918 and 1919. Since 1930, the court reported, the virus had been limited to transmission among swine only, with occasional transmission from swine to human and no secondary person-to-person transmission. When that transmission became more common, Congress responded with the Swine Flu Act of 1976. Turns out that there was no swine flu epidemic that year. The historical perspective is available in a court opinion of all places because people who got sick post-vaccination sued. Congress understood that such litigation was possible, and so, with what the court called the collapse of the commercial liability insurance market and vaccine makers' worries about liability, Congress gave anyone allegedly injured by the vaccine the right to sue the government. The Swine Flu Act also wiped away any possible cause of action against the vaccine's manufacturer. So now we have in the law books swine flu history in cases like Young versus United States, Petty versus United States, and Hassler versus United States, all cases brought by people who claimed injury or illness after the swine flu vaccination. By 1981, one court reported that 4,000 people had filed administrative claims post-vaccine and that 1,500 claims were pending in federal court. Some plaintiffs didn't win their cases. Even though the government had technically accepted responsibility for injuries, the plaintiff still had to prove causation, proof that the vaccine had caused their injury or illness. But once the government itself suggested that plaintiffs needed to show only that they had developed a distinctive neurological condition associated with the vaccine, some courts decided in the plaintiff's favor. After all, one court noted, the government spun the vaccine as a patriotic duty, personal sacrifice for the good of the country. So should the government ever again attempt something like a national swine flu immunization program, expect the experiences it had both in 1976 and in later litigation to influence some key decisions. The next time the government asks us to sacrifice for the common good in vaccinating ourselves against disease, it may also seek to immunize itself. I'm Amy Guida.
Earth and Sky.
Today, is the world running out of oil?
The world is not running out of oil at the moment.
That's Dr. Willem Scholte, chief scientist for reservoir engineering for Shell. He says that while there is a lot of oil and natural gas remaining, it's getting harder to recover.
For the medium term, we have